Bring in show music, please.
Today on Squawk Pod.
It's crazy and it's insane.
Trump allies planning to roll back the independence of the Federal Reserve.
Yes.
Well, that's
why
I mean.
My hair's on fire.
If the former president...
I don't have any hair either.
...wins another term in office.
You look like you're doing pretty well up there.
I'd pay a lot for that.
Nick Timiraos of The Wall Street Journal with The Scoop joins us.
The Senate Republicans I spoke to did not like this idea very much.
Is there bird flu in your milk? Former FDA Commissioner Scott Gottlieb on what could be a risk.
First of all, I wouldn't drink raw milk. I would never drink raw milk. I wouldn't drink it now.
Plus, the tech megagiants betting on AI and boosting benefit to investors with CNBC's Steve Kovac.
Why pay a dividend then?
Same reason Meta did it. It's giving the shareholders what they wanted.
I'm CNBC producer Zach Felici. It's Friday, April 26th. Squawk Pod begins right now.
Stand Becky by in 3, 2, 1. Cue, please.
Good morning, everybody. Welcome to Squawk Box right here on CNBC. We are live from the NASDAQ market site in Times Square. I'm Becky Quick, along with Joe Kernan and Andrew Ross Sorkin.
New this morning, a report breathtaking in so many ways. I imagine it will be the talk of the town, at least on Wall Street and elsewhere. The Wall Street Journal now reporting that Donald Trump's allies are quietly drafting proposals that would attempt to erode the Federal Reserve's independence. The former president wins a second term. A small group of Trump's allies are now arguing that he should be consulted on interest rate decisions, that Fed regulation should be subject to the White House review, and that the president should be more forcefully be able to use the Treasury Department as a check on the central bank. The group also argues that if Trump wins a second term, he should have the authority to oust Fed Chair Jay Powell before his term ends in 2026. The journal saying it wasn't clear if Trump was aware of the proposals and that the work was so secretive that some prominent former Trump economic aides weren't aware of it. A spokesperson for Trump's campaign saying if it's not coming from us, don't take it as official, but not denying it either. I have to say, I mean, just as somebody who lives in this world, I think if you're in the world of finance and you think that the president is going to do this explicitly, look, it was always there's always been some level of implicit pressure points and things. And we heard Trump, you know, even publicly, you know, make comments about the Fed.
We heard H.W. Bush make comments about the Fed.
You know, I remember talking to Paul Volcker before he passed away, and he talked about conversations he had with James Baker on behalf of Reagan back in the day. But I just want to read this to you because this is very, very different. Some of the former president's advisors have discussed requiring that candidates for the Fed chair privately agree to consult informally with Trump on the central bank's decisions. Others have made the case that Trump himself could sit on the Fed board of governors on an acting basis, an option that several people close to the former president described as far-fetched. But nonetheless, I mean, I just, for those in the finance world who've sort of said, okay, you know, I like the tax policies, or I'm okay with this, or I like this, or this about, this is different.
Yeah,
if the Federal Reserve is...
There's no names attached to it.
Genuinely not going to be independent.
There's no names attached to it, and the people they did ask said they don't know anything about it and don't even take it seriously. I'd like to know, who are the people? Peter Navarro? I mean, or not to disparage him, but... Yeah, I don't know about the sources, but which allies of Trump, if Trump doesn't even know about it, which it says there, he may or may not.
Well, we don't know. And
that's what I'm saying. So, but who is this? I mean, how crazy are, and what constitutes an ally versus a confidant and someone that actually would be policymaking?
Can we all just say we think it's a crazy situation to have the idea of a president?
But,
to have a president sitting on board
like more
that.
About them.
It's crazy and it's insane. I don't know who the allies are. I imagine, look, it's running the top of the Wall Street Journal's website right now.
Right.
They're citing multiple people who they claim are close to the president. I do believe there are people close to the president who have views that may be like this, that I wouldn't dispute. I think you wouldn't dispute that either.
I know a couple.
You know a couple.
And
he surrounded himself with a whole bunch of people. By the way, a story like this, by the way, to me, unto itself, undermines the credibility of a future Fed under President Trump. And the truth is that it would make it harder to find a credible individual to run the Federal Reserve, because invariably, now that this story has been published, even, and the president, by the way, hasn't said this is absolutely crazy, we do not agree with this at all, which the spokesperson did not do.
Right.
Let's say you name your next Federal Reserve chair. What is the first question that everybody at this table and everybody on Wall Street is going to be asking?
Are you independent? Do you have
are you independent? Have you made a secret deal with the president? We're aware that his allies are working on a secret deal with you.
I don't think I would ask it that way. I think I would probably say, did you have any agreement with the president beforehand
sure.
that you would consult with him before? Any?
But my point is,
because otherwise you can say, no, I didn't have a secret deal.
But I'm saying
20 people
the public
it.
Is going to sit around as we are right this second and say that there's something untoward
who
going
would,
on here.
After what happened at Jay Powell, all through the first Trump, no, God forbid, but all through Trump's administration, who would want the job anyway, given the daily tongue-lashing that poor Jay Powell got?
I think we know a bunch of people who would like the,
right,
would like
but
the
they,
job.
They would be taking it, you know, eyes wide open to what to expect from what we saw with the jawboning for almost daily on Jay Powell.
You made it forget about a private coercion. This
yeah,
was
we
this
already
was
saw
full
how just
coercion.
Relentless as a real estate guy Trump was about lower rates. I mean, you could have, I don't know if there's any scenario. And most presidents are like that. They want lower rates because they want to have a strong economy.
Sure. I'm just
but he was more outspoken than anyone.
This very
else.
Concept, though, that
right.
there are people that are close to the president, the former president, talking about these things and want to approach it in such a coordinated way undermines the credibility of whoever that person would be if they would ever get that job. Mm-hmm. Just by default. By default, you're going to look at that person and you're going to say, are you a puppet of this president?
You would need to see more about this, actually, the veracity of it actually being a serious proposal and who we're talking about that's proposing it before your hair totally is gone from being on fire. I would just want to know, you know, is it really a possibility? I mean, think of the people that advised Trump on other matters. And
correct. Yes.
Right. Well, that's
why my hair's on fire.
Right.
My hair's on fire for a reason.
Giuliani.
They could be crazy.
Yeah.
Jason Miller.
Look at the people around him. Right. If that's not saying something to you, I don't know what is. That's the point.
That's saying something
that's
to me.
That's the point.
But yeah, okay. The people advising the current guy on myriad subjects. I don't have any hair either.
Well, you look like you're doing pretty well up there. So,
well, I'd pay a lot for that. But but a conflicted Fed, it worries me more
yes.
than a conflicted Justice Department.
Both worry me, and if you look at
more
the inflationary prospects, that would be the concern of a weaponized
Justice Department.
Yeah, Justice Department.
Have you not seen the Supreme Court? Call me and let me know what you're thinking.
What have they done? That you don't like.
It was the questioning yesterday that people are talking about with the new thing. We'll see.
Trump is screwed.
Yeah.
High court poised to reject Trump's immunity claims.
But
most of the people said that there will be
some kind of middle ground, Solomonic solution.
Exactly.
I mean, you know, the Supreme Court's its own branch. I mean, it's not part of the administration. It's not a.
The Fed's supposed to be independent.
I mean,
too.
The Department of Justice.
The Fed's supposed to be independent. It's
AG
not laid out in the Constitution.
I know, but
it's supposed to be independent.
If you're weaponizing the Justice Department, you can't say, "Well, yeah, look at the Supreme Court." The Supreme Court might be the only governor on a weaponized Justice Department.
But it becomes complicated when so many of the individuals have been nominated put in place by one person.
Tough
toenails, my friend. That's the way it worked out.
And Democrats
doesn't mean that you add 15 members, which is probably what you'd like to do. But that's the way it turns out. It's going to be a conservative court for a while. I'm sorry that happened, but it is. It is what it is.
It is. But there it is.
6-3, baby.
As
6-3, baby.
Right. And you're happy. And all I'm saying is that is that unto itself.
I'm not that happy.
Its own credibility.
Not that happy.
Issues.
It's not 7-2.
But you see
it's not 8-1.
But you understand why that undermines actually.
No, I understand why
that undermines even the sense of democracy in this country, because a lot of people feel that they're underrepresented as a result of that.
Well, so, you know, having an open southern border undermines democracy as well. There's a lot of I can do both sidism till you're blue in the face, even on.
I know
Friday.
You can. You're very good. You're very good at. Joining us right now is one of the authors of this article, Nick Timiraos, chief economics correspondent for The Wall Street Journal, now known as one of the great whisperers around the Federal Reserve. Nick, tell us about this report. Tell us about How close you think Donald Trump is to all of this, or whether we're just talking about some, crazy people off to the side? What are we supposed to think here?
Well, Andrew, it's a good question. I think the challenge with this is that there isn't the normal campaign policy apparatus with the Trump campaign. And that was what we saw in the first term in the White House. I think whatever the different advisors or people around the president put in front of him has a chance of becoming policy, at least for that day or for that period of time. And so I think you have to take seriously what different people around the president are proposing or would like to propose to him, because if it's something that he wants to do, he can turn to them and say, yeah, let's do this. And so I think what you have right now, I mean, in some respects, the story is surprising because this idea that you would have, an arrangement with the Fed that is not the norm that we've had in the last 40 years. But on the other hand, it's not that surprising because look at what the first Trump term was like. This is what the president wanted to have. He wanted to have a Fed chair who he could call and he could say rates need to go down right now or you need to stop raising interest rates. And so I think the challenge here is just who is going to be the Fed chair if Donald Trump has a second term? Who is going to be, the NEC director, the Treasury secretary? Because the personnel will be policy. The people who have these jobs will get to determine whether the institutional norms that have existed with the Fed continue.
I was surprised that when you saw a comment from the administration, rather than deny this was happening or say that they know nothing about it and that they would condemn it and it wasn't something that they were interested in, they didn't take that opportunity. Did that surprise you?
Not really. I don't read much into that. I think, like I said, there's just not a conventional policy process with the campaign, or really there wasn't much of a conventional policy process at the end of the first term. I think there are two, important differences from the first term if Donald Trump is reelected. One is that, when he took the presidency in 2017, the Fed had a number of vacancies. So he had an early opportunity to remake the Fed board. Now, he picked more of establishment figures like Randy Quarles and Jay Powell. This time, if you look at who he was nominating at the end of his first term, you had different, more idiosyncratic choices like Judy Shelton, Herman Cain. But this time around, Andrew, he won't have vacancies on the Fed board unless people leave. There are seven governors. All the seats are filled. If nobody steps down, then it's a year before he gets vacancy.
You did put one thing in it. You just said you talked to someone and you're right. I don't know who's in charge. And he's got some other things going on that it's probably not as cohesive a campaign when you're due somewhere else every single day. But even in your report, you say, what is it? Let's be very clear. If it doesn't come directly from the strategy session, don't take it seriously. I mean, they said that, didn't they?
They did. Yeah, they absolutely did say that. But, Donald Trump is talking to people right now about the Fed. He's interested in different views. He's thinking about this. He cares about the Fed a lot. He thinks a lot about interest rates. He knows what 25 basis point increase in interest rates will do.
Right.
The second point I was going to make is
Republicans wouldn't go along with it. I mean, you also quote people in the article. There's two or three guys that said there's no way this would ever happen. And you got to get confirmation of anybody.
But he's saying he'll do it secretly, too. And part of the story, which was that he said that there was going to be an implicit secret arrangement made effectively between a candidate who would have to effectively pledge their allegiance to the president,
but then be confirmed,
with a private secret deal that they're going to be talking to each other to basically get approval before they make these decisions. I mean, I don't know, Nick. I read the story and I thought, if true, this is outrageous. So why don't we start calling a spade a spade?
Well, I'm not sure. I mean, you're right. The person that the president ultimately picks to run the Fed, that is how the president gets to influence monetary policy. I mean, that is the institutional arrangement we have. And then the question about whether Senate Republicans would go along with this. When we started hearing about this some time ago, I started talking to Senate Republicans to see what they thought. And you can see, I mean, we put them in the article. The Senate Republicans I spoke to did not like this idea very much. But the question is, at the end of the day, if Donald Trump is the president and he has a several seat majority in the Senate, Will he be able to get whoever he wants onto the Fed board and into the chair? That certainly seems possible. So I think it's something you have to take seriously.
I don't see how the Supreme Court is any less sacrosanct than the Fed. And you have... people on your side.
What you're saying is
to,
the next Fed chair is a Manchurian candidate. That's actually what we're saying here.
You want 15 people on the Supreme Court to have 9 liberal judges.
I didn't think that's at all.
Okay, some
understand.
People do. Some people want to do that.
No, I think there's
We've got more Squawk Pod ahead, including, do we have to be worried about bird flu now?
There's no reason to believe the pasteurization process isn't going to kill this virus.
And Google's parent company, Alphabet, announces its first ever dividend, a boon for shareholders.
Why does anyone ever buy a stock that doesn't pay a dividend?
This is Squawk Pod. Here's Joe.
Microsoft and Alphabet both reporting better than expected results and both accelerating their AI strategies, which is still, I guess, good. Steve Kovac, sometimes it can turn bad, joins us with more on how AI is impacting both tech giants. You got to spend money to
you
get there. But then when you start spending too much, comes a day.
Yeah. There is going to be more spending. We can talk about that in a minute. But right now, let's talk about these two monetization stories on artificial intelligence these two companies have been telling. But it's clear right now we're still in the very early days and not a lot of disclosure from either company on what's working. Just some promising nuggets of information showing both companies could be on the cusp of something big. For Microsoft, we saw the AI sales in the Azure Cloud unit. It contributed 7 percentage points of the overall 31% year-over-year revenue growth. That's up from 6% quarter-over-quarter. But that's where the AI story kind of ends as far as monetization goes. There was lots of mushy talk from CEO Satya Nadella on Copilot. At the end of the day, we really have no idea how well it's selling, but some little nuggets of information here. Nadella did mention a handful of companies that bought at least 10,000 subscriptions to Copilot. As for Google and Alphabet, CEO Sundar Pichai shot back at the idea Google's core search business was under threat from chatbot search engines like the one from the startup Perplexity. He said tests showed early increased usage in AI search. If that pans out, that's, of course, more chances to stuff ads in search. And beyond ads, Pichai said Google will monetize AI through subscriptions and, of course, the cloud, just like Microsoft's doing now. One other interesting argument from Pichai, they're not related to AI. He did say YouTube and Google Cloud combined will have a $100 billion run rate this year. That's kind of his way of saying Alphabet's more than just selling search ads, guys.
Right. Yeah, it's probably not. I was saying like streaming. I said that earlier. Remember how streaming, everybody, we're going to spend all this money on streaming.
Yeah.
And Disney went to like $200 because streaming, oh my God, streaming. And then
look at Paramount.
A year later, it's like, how much money are we spending on streaming?
But that's nothing compared to what they're spending.
And the promise is exponentially greater for AI.
And this was talked about on the call. So I think it was Mark Mahaney from Evercore who asked this, or someone else, basically saying, you guys are spending so much on AI, what makes you think that there's going to be a payoff down the road? And they basically talked about how flexible they're being because they're managing, they meaning Microsoft, managing their CapEx based on the demand they're seeing. Because keep in mind, they run all the OpenAI stuff on Azure, huge demand there. So they have to flex to the demand.
When you think Graham and Dodd, the only reason to ever buy a stock is that you hope the cash flow from the dividend keeps increasing over time as the company does better. So why does anyone ever, that's one argument, why does anyone ever buy a stock that doesn't pay a dividend? You're not guaranteed of getting anything back.
Well, we saw what happened with Alphabet there, and largely moved up because of that dividend.
Sometimes it goes the other way because it means the growth phase of the company is over.
But that's not what they're hinting at. They're hinting at we're on the cusp of the next growth phase because of AI,
and then you have to try pointing to
YouTube and cloud saying, hey, we're not just a search and ads business.
Right. But why pay a dividend then? Why not reinvest everything into it?
Same reason Meta did it. It's given the shareholders what they want. I mean, that we saw how the stock reacted.
Yeah, I wouldn't give it back if I were them. So I like it too.
You want to keep it for yourself?
Yeah. Thanks, Steve.
Tease will be next.
Coming up, Could your morning glass of milk be a health risk? Former FDA Commissioner Scott Gottlieb joins us to discuss reports of bird flu virus detected in pasteurized dairy.
If in fact they found live virus in milk, and I don't think they will, but if they did and they're looking, I'd be more inclined to believe it came through the bottling process and contamination on packaging than coming through the pasteurization process.
More Squawk Pod is right after this. You're listening to Squawk Pod.
Up and Becky, Q.
Moderna is betting big on artificial intelligence. The biotech company has joined forces with the creators of ChatGPT, OpenAI, to expand its employees' access to AI chatbots. Joining us right now to talk about the AI medicine revolution is former FDA Commissioner Scott Gottlieb. He is also a CNBC contributor, and he serves on the boards of Illumina and Pfizer. And Dr. Gottlieb, we should point out that you're an expert yourself in this. You're launching your own company this week, Xyra, which is an AI-based drug developer that you all have raised $1 billion for.
Right, backed by New Enterprise Associates, a venture capital firm where I'm a partner. Look, I think that the drug developers have been making use of AI tools for a very long time. If we look back even 20 years ago, they were making use of machine learning to do in silico drug design, basically design molecules on computers and also using modeling and simulation to do dose finding. What's different now is the use of large language models, not just for enterprise-level SG&A functions, but also in the drug discovery and drug development process. And so you're seeing the large drug makers try to get instances of large language models within their own ecosystem so they can now load their own data on it and use it in a proprietary fashion. I've seen a lot of drug makers partnering with Microsoft. It's interesting to see them also partnering with OpenAI to do the same thing. I think the real next inflection point is going to be when you can build very high quality clinical data training sets to design models that are purposely built to solve for human biology. Right now, we're using models that are borrowed from the consumer tech world, so they haven't been built to solve for human biology, and we don't really have good clinical data training sets. And that's the goal of the startup that we're funding, is to try to build models that are purposely built for biology.
Meaning models that are based on biology itself or models that are based on studies that have been done over 15, 20 years on all kinds of ways that these things play out? Like, how does it actually work?
Yeah, both. I mean, what's happening now is a lot of the data that we have to train models on, first of all, we're using consumer tech models, and then the data that we have to train those models on hasn't necessarily been collected in a fashion where it's optimized for training an artificial intelligence model, a large language model. So you might have proteomic or genomic data, but it's not correlated with phenotypes. Yeah. What we're going to try to do is do large-scale experimentation where we basically do perturbations at a very large scale. So think of changing genes and trying to figure out how it correlates with different phenotypes in the human body. So we have technology to do that. And when you do that at a very large scale, and you might even change genes in ways that don't exist in nature, you start to get a really good sense of the biology of different systems within the body, and then you can both build a model based on that information and train it more adequately.
Because so many of these clinical tests fail in the phase two, phase three studies on this, it shows great promise, but you can't get through the requirements that these tests are showed. You think we'll have better ability to more quickly get drugs to market?
I think we're both. I think, first of all, these tools are being used in different portions of the drug development process to try to bring efficiency. So something as simple as trying to pull together the application that you're filing with the agency, or looking at post-market data to monitor for adverse events and try to figure out causality from signals that you're identifying in the market. But it's also going to allow us, if we can truly understand biology of different systems and different disease states, it might allow us to identify targets that we wouldn't have perceived otherwise, because we might see something adjacent to where we were looking that's also impacting a disease state that the model's pointing us to, and then to design drugs that we might not have been able to do experimentally. So Xyra, the company I'm involved with, is going after protein-based drugs first and foremost. That's going to be the first target. Right now, for antibody drugs, we use experimental models like mice, where we have mice that replicate human immune systems, and we basically try to get the mice to produce antibodies and extract them. So it's a hit or miss process. Using an AI model, and this technology has been developed by David Baker at University of Washington, who's also a co-founder of the company. Using this model, you can try to design antibodies intelligently that bind to protein targets that you might not have been able to get antibodies to bind to before, because antibodies are the sum of small interactions, and sometimes it's very hard to figure out how to design an antibody to bind to certain targets. If you can't get a mouse to produce that particular antibody, you can't isolate it from a person.
How long before you actually see this stuff helping in the marketplace?
Well, we're seeing it already. I mean, other companies are already using these tools. I think, again, I think the inflection point is going to be when you do things more deliberately, when you instead of borrowing some of the models that have been developed for more of a technological application, you can actually develop models that are based on human biology and based on training sets that were built for the purpose of designing new models. And that's happening right now. You see things like what David Baker built, RF diffusion, which allows you to design antibodies to bind to different targets. You've seen what Google did with AlphaFold, which allows you to model the structure of an antibody. So we're seeing these tools being used already in drug development, but I think we're still at the early stages of this because we haven't done it in a deliberate fashion.
Scott, I mean, you think about metabolism and you think about all these processes, and we've been lucky different times to find things that one gene could, you know, it's got a mutation, go in and fix it somehow. But gene therapy and working on one gene is very rare. How many genes are involved in most diseases or conditions? Hundreds, thousands, or?
Yeah, you're getting right to the point.
Which is why AI.
Right, exactly.
The only way to understand it, the total picture of what you're doing and designing drugs to address it, it's, and for, I think about 15 years ago up at the Cancer Center at MIT, they got rid of the guy who was running it and put in like a data guy, almost an IT guy, because that
right.
The convergence of
that is
of
the point. Not only now you can look inside systems, the model might tell you different elements of biology that are all impacting a disease state. You might be able to target it with one drug, so you design a protein drug to hit multiple targets,
right.
Or you might be able to design multiple drugs and provide them in combination that you might not have perceived otherwise without the model being able to give you a much clearer picture of what the biology of the disease. Because we're focused in. We try to narrow our focus to try to find one causative feature of disease and then target that with a drug. That's historically how we've done it.
Yeah.
That's not how diseases arise.
No, never happened.
Scott, very quickly before you go, a lot of consumer concern about avian flu being detected in milk, in the nation's milk supply. Should I be concerned about drinking this? What's the impact?
No, you shouldn't be concerned. So what they're detecting is viral remnants of heat inactivated virus. And there's no reason to believe the pasteurization process. First of all, I wouldn't drink raw milk. I would never drink raw milk. I wouldn't drink it now. There's no reason to believe the pasteurization process isn't going to kill this virus. And if in fact they found live virus in milk, and I don't think they will, but if they did and they're looking, I'd be more inclined to believe it came through the bottling process and contamination on packaging than coming through the pasteurization process. What this shows you, though, the reason why FDA and CDC did this testing of milk is that that USDA and APHIS and state regulators wouldn't allow them on the farms to do more widespread testing because they didn't really want to turn over those cases. And so this is a backdoor way to do on-farm testing. Instead of testing the cows, you test the milk. And what we're finding is this virus is much more pervasive on dairy farms right now than what we originally perceived. And so that's unfortunate.
Is that a scary thing that it could jump?
It's unfortunate because the more that we allow this to spread in mammals, the more we're tempting fate that this could evolve in ways that it could threaten humans.
And they're not letting people on because they don't want to cull the herds?
This is a historical problem. So when I had outbreaks of E. coli in romaine lettuce, my inspectors weren't allowed onto the farms initially. So I sent the inspectors to test the adjacent farms, the water running off from the farms that I thought the E. coli was coming from. There's always been a tension between human health people who would want to swab everything and animal health people who are worried about some of the economic implications and don't want federal inspectors on their farms. And you're seeing that play out here as well. This is a very clever move by CDC and FDA to test the milk as a way to identify which farms have outbreaks. Hopefully it forces the hands of agricultural officials to allow more broad testing.
Can I get any immunity from the milk, from the fragments of the H1? How do you know?
You're not going to get immunity from fragments of
why? What if it's a spike protein? What if I got a spike protein from an H1N1?
Because it would have to be transcribed. It would have to be transcribed into the protein. The protein itself would probably be inactivated. I mean, maybe I don't.
I think I'm going to keep eating Frosted Flakes.
You know, there's a vaccine. There's also antiviral drugs for this particular strain.
I don't know.
Dr. Gottlieb, thanks.
Going it naturally.
Thanks for listening to today's Squawk Pod. A programming note, on May 4th, Warren Buffett will hold court in Omaha, answering shareholder questions for 5 hours at the Berkshire Hathaway annual meeting. If you're a Berkshire shareholder and have a question, send it to berkshirequestions@cnbc.com. Our Becky Quick will be reading through them and selecting some to ask during the meeting. Squawk Box is hosted by Joe Kernan, Becky Quick, and Andrew Ross Sorkin.
I can do both sides until you're blue in the face, even on
Friday. I know you can.
Watch on CNBC weekday mornings at 6 Eastern. And follow Squawk Pod to listen to the best of our show anytime. Have a great weekend. We'll meet you back here on Monday.
We are clear. Thanks, guys.